We are excited to have him this morning. Currently, he is at Highland Church of Christ, and according to him, he does what everybody else doesn't want to do. So we're excited to have him this morning, and look forward to an engaging, informative, and convicting message.
All right, thanks so much. I'm glad when people laugh at that joke, because sometimes I'll say something and I don't get any laughter. So I appreciate that very much. You know, if you are a teacher, if you are a student, or if you have anybody in your family who falls into either one of those categories, you are well aware of the fact that we're about 2 weeks into a new semester of school, aren't we? Whether you're a grade school student, a high school student, a college student, we're a couple of weeks in. And what that means is that the excitement has started to go away. All of the gear up to go back, all of the new school supplies, a new pencil, whatever it might be. Well, it's more than pencils now. It's calculators and computers. But it was exciting when you went in for that first day of school, that first day of class, that new beginning, that new and fresh start. But 2 weeks into it, the luster's wearing off just a little bit, hasn't it? I mean, now the reality has set in. The assignments are staring people in the face. Even if you're a teacher, you go in now and you think, I hope those kids would change over Christmas. But they didn't. They're the same group that was here during the first semester. I always started, as I went through school, I always started with the same dream at the beginning of every semester. At the beginning of every term, I said, and I was determined, and I meant it. I said, you know what? This is going to be my semester. This is going to be my time. I'm going to get straight A's. I'm going to work. I'm going to do all my homework every night and turn it in on time. And when the dust settles, I'm going to have all A's. I was ready to go. But then reality set in. My friends wanted to do things. They'd call and say, hey, let's go do this. You start getting distracted. Oh, look, it's the NFL playoffs. This afternoon we have a pair of conference championship games. I can't do homework during those. I've got to watch football. I've got to watch baseball. I've got to play. I've got to do things. And before you know it, the dream of straight A's went by the boards. It's not, Joe, though, just students who face that, is it? It's adults, too. We all face that. We've just come through the new year. It is now, let's see, it's January 19th. And my bet is that many of us made New Year's resolutions coming into 2020, didn't we? I mean, 2020 is an even year. That's a great time to make a New Year's resolution. January 1, perfect time to start out with a new beginning. But by the 19th of January, I'm also willing to wager that many of those, if not most of those New Year's resolutions, have gone by the boards, haven't they? That resolution that, hey, this is the year. Mine is. This is the year that finally that last 20 pounds comes off. Well, then people started, we started having a couple of dinners. And then we have a senior citizens dinner up at Highland every month called the Joy Group. And they have pies all the time. And man, it's good. And I've blown it already. I don't know if I'll make that last 20 or not this year. But for most of us, we start out with such great intentions, with such great hopes, with such great dreams to accomplish the things that are significant in our lives, those things that are meaningful. Unfortunately, those things that are significant, those things that are meaningful are often not achieved simply because we get distracted by the things that seem important right here and right now. Well, unfortunately, this same concept, this same thing is true in our spiritual lives as well. I mean, when we first came to faith, we came out of the baptistry ready to take the hill, didn't we? We came out of the baptistry, we said, my life has changed. I'm ready. I am ready to live for Jesus. I'm going to be the most faithful follower of His that has ever existed. And then we got back to the routine of life, didn't we? That routine of life settled in just a little bit. And we didn't mean for it to. But our passion died off just a little, didn't it? And we started to maybe even fall back into a little bit of the pattern that we'd known before. But we'd come back out, we'd go back in, we'd come back out, we'd go back in. And pretty soon, following Jesus in the passing lane on the interstate, it turned into wandering around on a two-lane country road detour. And we lost some of that passion, we lost some of that fervor. But you know, having our most meaningful spiritual needs and our most meaningful spiritual values sidetracked by what we want in the short term isn't unique to us. That doesn't mean it's good, but it's not unique. In fact, that has been going on through the entire history of Christianity. It's been going on for thousands of years, and fortunately, since it's been going on for that long, there is some encouragement and there is instruction on how to keep our Christian life on the right track. How to keep on following Jesus and keep that passion and keep that fervor in our lives, even as we follow Him through our whole lives. In Hebrews chapter 12, that's going to be our scripture for today. If you have your Bible, go ahead and turn to it if you would. Pull it up on your tablet, your phone, whatever it is that you use for that purpose. But we're going to take a look at Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 this morning. Lay this down right here for right now. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And this is a letter to the Hebrews, to Jewish Christians, in all likelihood written by Paul. We're not positive or sure about that, but pretty close. We'll call it by Paul. And as Paul writes, he is going to give one of his favorite analogies. And he's going to compare following Jesus to a race. Of all the analogies that Paul uses in the New Testament, farmer, soldier, etc., athlete, the most common one that he uses, the favorite one that he seems to use, is that of a race. He uses it several times, and here he takes a little bit of a different turn and twist on it, because the word that he uses here for race is a word that's pronounced agane. Now, if I came up to you this morning and I said, you know, I found this word in a Greek Bible, and it's the word agone. What would you think it sounded like to you? Agony. Agony, absolutely. And when Paul looks at this race, he uses the word agone, which we think of as agony. And the word, I think the word's appropriate, because it describes not a sprint, not a 100-meter dash, not a 200-meter dash. This word describes a long and difficult race. Much more like a marathon, like Boston or New York or Chicago marathons, or even an Ironman triathlon like they have all over the world and especially in the Hawaiian Islands. And as he talks about this race, though, he talks about a long and lengthy period of racing to follow Jesus himself. In fact, this is a race that lasts our entire life. It's a race that doesn't end until we do. And Paul writes and he says these words, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race, the agone, marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." Now, as we take a look at this scripture this morning, we're going to find a couple of things in this passage. One, we're going to find out that Paul has some encouragement for each one of us as we run the race. And secondly, we're going to find some teaching. We're going to find some instruction. We're going to find what we might call some coaching tips to run this race well, and to run this race successfully. So let's dive in, and right off the bat, Paul is going to encourage us by reminding us of all the people, this great cloud of witnesses, all of the people who have already run this race and are waiting for us at the finish line. And by the fact that they've run it and they're waiting for us at the finish tells us that we can run it too. It was British journalist John Bryant who said that the serious pursuit of running a sub-4-minute mile started in 1886. And in spite of the best efforts of athletes and trainers and the nutritionists of their day and all of the coaching that could possibly happen in that time, it wasn't until 68 years later, on May 6, 1954, that Roger Bannister became the first person to run that sub-4-minute mile. And he did it with a time of 3:59.4. He barely made it. But he did. He got in under the wire on that 4-minute mile. Now, pretty quickly, though, running a sub-4-minute mile became almost routine. After it took 68 years of intense effort and difficulty and trying and science and training and everything else, 68 years to run the first one, it was only 46 days later that a fellow named John Landy ran the mile in 3:58. Less than a year later, in a single race, three runners finished under 4 minutes. You see, when we see that something's possible, when we see that something can be done, when we know it can be done, it gives us confidence to do it as well, doesn't it? Well, we're not the first to run this race of faith. And all around us are examples of people who have already finished the race successfully, who have already completed it. And in chapter 11, Paul lists some of those heroes of our biblical faith who have run and finished this race, doesn't he? He talks about Noah and Abraham and Sarah and Moses and David and Samuel and a list of others who have already run, who have already finished, who are waiting for us to do the same. Beyond those biblical heroes, though, all of us, I think, have a list of personal heroes who have run the race of faith, don't we? For some, it might be parents or grandparents, brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, whoever that might be in our lives, our relatives, our friends who have finished already and wait for us at the finish line. For me, one of the people I think about when I think about that group is my fourth and fifth grade Sunday school teacher, Mrs. Wantland. She had to have been a saint to put up with us in the fourth and fifth grade. It was a rowdy bunch of boys, and we had a great time, and we learned a lot. But Mrs. Wantland's husband was a retired minister who couldn't get around very well. And she cared for him, and at the same time, she taught us, and she encouraged us each and every week, each and every Sunday, and prayed for us each and every day. I'm sure all of us can name the people in our lives who are our examples. They show us that running the race and completing our lives as faithful followers of Jesus is possible. They motivate us and they encourage us even as they've gone on before us. Well, not only does Paul encourage us by reminding us about the people who have run the race ahead of us, he also gives us some coaching tips. He gives us some instruction on how we can be successful in running this race as well. And in the first piece of coaching, Paul lets us know about a couple of things we need to get rid of and set aside in order to run this race well. The first one he calls everything that hinders. Everything that hinders. And it has to do with the idea of putting aside anything and everything that would weigh us down while we run a race. Now, how many of you have ever bought a piece of exercise equipment? Anybody? Anybody ever buy a treadmill, a bicycle? I won't ask about the Peloton because that'll just give away the fact that you spent a lot of money on a piece of exercise equipment. All right. I did see, what was it, the mirror that you see advertised? That's only $1,500 and a $40 a month subscription. I'm not buying one of those. Now, of all of us who have purchased, and I'm in that number, of all of us who have purchased a piece of exercise equipment, how many of those pieces of equipment have ended up being extra clothes hangers or places of storage? Yes. Oh, yes. For most of us, right? We buy those things a lot, and then we get excited about them, and we use them, and we find out that's a heck of a lot of work. It looked easy on TV, but not in real life. Now, one of the things that I bought a long time ago, and maybe some of you have purchased these too, I bought a set of ankle weights when I was a teenager, and I thought, man, this is great. I'm going to strap these ankle weights on, and you know, they range from like 1 to 4 pounds or something like that, and the idea is that you wear these when you work out. You wear them when you run, and then when it's time to play a game or it's time to run a race, you take those weights off, and man, you can feel like you were flying, right? It did not work well for me. I kept feeling like I was wearing the ankle weights most of the time, but you get the idea. You're setting aside the weight that would slow you down. You're setting aside anything that would hinder you from performing at your peak. Now, if you go to a high school track meet, you'll see this in action. We have a lot, and I know you all do too. Lawrenceville has some phenomenal athletic facilities down here. And I go to some of the high school track meets, and you'll see the tents all set up with the different teams, and you'll see these students, and because usually in track it's cold, because it's early spring, you know, most of the time, and you see people huddled up in their sweats and their coats and everything else. But then, when it comes time to run the race, what happens? All that stuff comes off, doesn't it? All the sweats come off, all the coats come off, and it's spandex and speed suits for less wind resistance. It's the lightest shoes possible until the race is over. We set aside those things that would hinder us. We set aside those things that would weigh us down, that would slow us down. And every one of us in every stage of life has things that would weigh us down and distract us from our main goal of running the race of faith. As young adults, we're trying to get our education, get established in a career, aren't we? Not to mention maybe even trying to find someone special to spend the rest of our life with. That takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of attention. Then we think when we get that career established and we find that someone and we start to move forward in that career, we think things are going to go smoothly. We think the distractions are behind us, but then kids come along and life changes quickly, doesn't it? And life can quickly become all about the kids and their school activities and their sports and their cheer and their dance and their gymnastics and their band. And you get the idea. All of the endless list of things that our kids will be involved in. But then the kids move out of the house and it's freedom. And life is good. As empty nesters, we look around and we think, this is awesome. We can take those bedrooms and turn them into anything we want. We can buy more exercise equipment and put it in there. Okay, maybe not. But as empty nesters, we find that we have more discretionary income, and that can easily translate into more toys. It can easily translate into more trips and more time spent on both of those things. Now, none of those things in any stage of life are necessarily bad, are they? Now, none of those things are evil. But sometimes they can become distractions. They can become the weights that slow us down, and we purposefully have to keep them in their proper priority. And one of the ways we can do that, of course, is keep close tabs on our calendar. Keep close tabs on our bank balance. I do mine online. Maybe you do too. And you can see at a glance where has the money gone. And sometimes we look at it and we think, man, maybe, whether it's the calendar or the bank account, we think, man, maybe these things are going in a different direction than I want them to. And so when we see that our career pursuits, our kids' activities, our trips, our toys, or anything that's not eternally significant keeps us from running well and distracts us from running the race of faith, those things might need to be set aside or lessened in their priority in order to make room for the highest priorities in our lives. Paul says, throw off those things that hinder. That's the first piece of coaching. The second thing we need to do to run the race well is a little bit like that, because Paul says what we need to do is to get rid of the sin that so easily entangles. One of the best sequences of video I've ever seen that just illustrates this point was an 800-meter race. I believe it was in Australia. And the runners are running. And you know, in an 800, you're not in a dead sprint, but you're pretty close to it. And they're moving fast, and they're just coming around the back turn. And there's a fellow who's leading this race, and it looks like he's going to win it. And in the infield of the track, you can also see that the pole vault's going on. As the runners come around the last turn and into the home stretch, a guy goes for the pole vault, and he goes up, and he hits the bar, and something happens, and a bungee cord-looking thing flies off the pole vault standard, flies onto the track, and wraps itself around the guy who's leading the 800-meter race. Unbelievable! It gets wrapped around him, and of course, you can't run if you've got a cord wrapped around you. He's tangled up, and he has to almost stop, pull that cord off, and he ends up finishing third or fourth. I can't imagine how that guy felt, but what I do know is that's what sin does to us. Sin wraps us up. Sin tangles us up, and sin makes it difficult, if not impossible, to run the race of faith. Now, getting tangled up in sin is easy, isn't it? I mean, there is nothing. You don't have to try hard to get tangled up in sin. We let our temptation, we let our guard down for just a minute, we give in to temptation, and the next thing you know, we're all tied up, we're all tangled up. We're not running the race as effectively as we could and should be. The question is, though, how do we throw off sin so we can keep on running? Well, I think there's a little sequence we need to go through. And first, we need to recognize that it's there. We need to recognize that there is sin in our lives. It's easy for you and I to minimize sin, isn't it? We say to ourselves, it's just once. That's a small thing. It's no big deal. But what we need to realize is what God calls sin. And what God calls sin, all sin, every sin, is rebellion against Him. Rebellion against Him. It's no small thing. It's a big thing. And calling it what it is, sin, instead of an error in judgment or a mistake or a misstep, is step number one in dealing with it. Now, since we do have a tendency to be slightly self-deceptive, however, one of the best ways to find that sin is to ask God to reveal it in our lives. We can offer a prayer like the prayer in Psalm 139:23, where the psalmist wrote, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Well, after we've found out what it is, after we've figured out that it is sin, next we need to confess that sin, to let God know that we agree with Him that it is indeed sin that we're participating in. Third, we need to ask for and respond to God's help to resist temptation. 1 Corinthians 10:13 says this, "No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. And when you are tempted, He will also provide you a way out so that you can endure it." And then finally, after we've done all that, after we've asked for help, after we've recognized it's sin, after we've confessed it, finally, we need to be open and transparent. Ask our small group or maybe some close Christian friends for help and for accountability as we move forward. Now, at the end of the day, there is nothing that will keep us completely free from sin. Sin is common to all of us. But following this kind of a process, following these kinds of steps, will keep that sin, hopefully, from continually tangling us up and preventing us from running this race of faith. Hopefully, that allows us to keep our focus where it belongs as we run. And that's the final coaching instruction that Paul gives us. He tells us to fix our eyes on Jesus, to focus on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of faith. Now, like most of you, I took driver's ed in high school. And driver's ed wasn't a bad experience. In fact, it was a pretty good experience. We showed up for the first day, and Coach Simons, the wrestling coach at Stephen Decatur High School, was the driver's ed instructor for us. And so Tom Rohde and I, the guy that I was going to share the car with for the next 6 weeks, showed up. Coach Simons looked at us, and he said, "Fellas, you can be honest with me. Have you already been driving?" And Tom and I looked at each other, and we thought, is this a trick? If we say yes, do we go to jail? I don't, because it's illegal. So we finally just kind of went, yeah, we've been driving already. And Coach Simon says, good. We'll skip the parking lot part. We'll get right on the road because I got dry cleaning to pick up and I need a cup of coffee. So let's go. So we went, and for the next 6 weeks, we helped Coach Simons do all his errands for about 45 minutes. We got really good at driving through drive-thrus. And in fact, well, and there's an art to that, you know. You see a lot of scrapes on the paint over there, and we got pretty good at that. We picked up mail, dry, whatever it was, we did. But we had a great experience. But you know what? I did learn a lot in driver's training, but one of the most important things that I learned there was where to keep your eyes. And what I learned was that if you keep your eyes on the end of your hood, you're not going to drive very straight. You're going to be constantly doing those little mini corrections. What you got to do when you drive is keep your head up. Keep your eyes focused out. See the whole road. See on both sides of the road. See the distance. You'll not only be safer, but you'll drive straighter as well. The meaning of the word that Paul uses to keep our eyes, to keep our focus on Jesus, is really a compound word. It's a combination of two words. The first piece of it means to look away from something, and the second means to look at something else. So in essence, it means look away from this so you can look at that. Look away from the end of the hood so that you can look out and see the horizon and see what's up ahead. Look away from things in our immediate vicinity and look out and look to the example of Jesus that He's set for us. You know, when we run a race, we're not looking at the crowd. We're not looking at our own feet. We're not looking at the other runners. That is a sure way to lose. If we want to win, our focus is on the goal. And in this case, that goal is following the teaching and the example of Jesus throughout our entire lives. He's the author and perfecter. He's the leader and the guide, and He is where our eyes need to be focused. If we want to finish the race, we keep our eyes on Him because He's already run the course. And He's there to show us the way. When we're focused on Jesus, when we're focused on Him, the words of the old hymn come true. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in His wonderful face, and the things of earth will go strangely dim in the light of His glory and grace. You know, every year the Ironman Triathlon World Championships are held on the lava fields of Kailua Kona, Hawaii. The 140.6-mile race consists of a 2.4-mile ocean swim, followed by 112 miles of biking, capped off by a full marathon of 26.2 miles. The people who run this thing are nuts. They're crazy. Who would put themselves through all this? As we get ready to end our message today, as we get ready to end our time in this scripture, I want you to know a little bit more about that race. The contestants have 17 hours to complete the course. 2 years ago, the winner finished in 7 hours and 52 minutes, and winning is great. But the real goal of an Ironman triathlon is to finish the race. As each racer crosses the finish line, there's a giant announcement, and he or she learns beyond a shadow of a doubt that they are an Ironman. When the time runs out on your race, what is it that you're going to hear? By running this spiritual race with perseverance, continually throwing off the short-sighted things that hinder and the sin that entangles, and keeping our eyes in the right place by focusing on Jesus, you and I can have the opportunity to say with Paul and all the others who have finished this race and wait for us at the end, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Now, as we get ready to end our time together today, it may be that you've not even begun the race yet. And it may be that this is a time when you've said to yourself, it's time I got in this thing. It's time I got in this race. It's time I ran like I mean it. And you do that by accepting Christ, by being baptized into Him. And we're going to sing a song in just a minute that'll give you an opportunity to make that decision. Or maybe you say, you know what, I've been running this race, but I kind of been running it by myself, and I need to be a part of a team. I need to be a part of a group that'll run this race with me. And so maybe you want to become a part of this congregation. You want to be a part of this body of believers and run the race of faith together. Or maybe you started the race. There's some things that got in your way. Things that started to hinder you. Things that started to tangle you up. And today, you've become determined that you're going to throw those things off. And you're going to run the race of faith like you've never run it before. You're going to do some business with God. And you can do that right in your seat today if you want to. Or you can come up and people will be here. They'll pray with you and pray for you. Whatever your need is today, respond to that as we stand together and we sing together.